From the Spec Network, this is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show.
How many times have you wanted to create an application with a map, but you wanted that map to have a custom look to it? And then you kind of went down the route of trying to customize that map and realizing that you'd have to hop through a whole bunch of hoops to get things done. Well, probably more than one if you're like me. Thankfully, there's a company out there to help you, and that's Mapbox. Mapbox is a location data platform that enables developers to build experiences for understanding and exploring our world. In short, Mapbox has an Android SDK that you can plug into your application with just a few lines of code. It'll give you display accurate turn-by-turn driving, walking, or biking navigation, and real-time traffic right there in your Android app. This is huge. The other cool thing that I really like about it is that they offer you complete map design control. So if your application is dark themed, you can theme it to your dark theme. If it's a light themed application, you have a light themed map and so forth. So this is tremendously important and thankfully so much easier to do. They offer a whole bunch of other things, such as location search, which is also known as geocoding and reverse geocoding, retrieving your device location, geospatial analysis, and the list goes on and on and on. So if this sounds like something that's interesting to you, you need a map, definitely check out Mapbox. I recommend that you join thousands of companies and hundreds of thousands of developers who've already integrated Mapbox into their Android project. You can visit mapbox.com/android to get started. Again, that's mapbox.com/android. Kaushik, we just recorded a little while ago, but for some reason it still feels like it's been a long time since we've recorded at the same time.
It always feels like that, doesn't it? I guess there's a lot usually happening in the Android development world, and we tend to just forget that, you know, this whole recording thing happens once or multiple times a month.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Well, again, it's good to be back on the air with you. So who are we talking to today?
Ooh, we have someone extremely exciting today. She's a little sick, so you may not usually recognize her voice, but nevertheless, she's extremely energetic and always a pleasure to talk to. So without further ado, we should welcome to the show Christina. Hi, Christina.
Hi. I'm wondering how many people knew it was me from that intro. I bet a very significant amount.
Christina, you are very well known in the Android area.
Oh, I don't know about that.
But for the folks that maybe are maybe listening to us for the first time, or maybe they're just come to the industry and are just learning of you, would you mind giving a little bit of background about who you are, where you work, kind of what you do, and maybe how you got into Android?
Yes. So my name is Christina Lee. Like you said, I am an Android engineer at Pinterest, and I currently work on the platform team there. Specifically, I work on a team called Core UI, which builds components that other developers use to make beautiful UIs. How I got into Android? Gosh, how do people get into software in general? Mostly, I thought I did not want to do anything with software, and then the world taught me better, and now I'm here. But I guess the more concrete example of that is I started doing Android a couple years back at a startup, and that was just because there was a need. It's one of those situations where you have four people and all surfaces need to ship, so you learn skills as you go, and I fell in love with it, and the rest has been history.
Wow, that's pretty similar to most of our background. I mean, my background is very similar too. Basically, I had no intentions of being a mobile developer, but then there was the need, and then, you know, when you're at a startup, you typically don't have that many options. So, but I did not go running across the country before doing it.
No. I mean, highly recommended. So if you want to reconsider.
I would usually take your advice on all things Android development, Christina, but it's something tells me that this one I'm gonna pass on this recommendation.
Oh, but it's fun.
For those who are curious, we did talk to Christina on a previous episode. I think this is one of our Google I/O episodes, and she tells us the whole story of her very adventurous run across the country. This is not hyperbole. She literally ran across the country. So that should help people understand the amount of energy that Christina has.
Just a little bit.
It should come close.
That being said, so one thing I wanted to bring up was the Pinterest Android app. Now and then, I definitely tend to use the Pinterest Android app. In fact, I opened it now, and in my stream, I see a whole bunch of Bruce Lee pictures and a lot of extremely nerdy stuff, which I imagine is not the primary use case for Pinterest. Nevertheless, the app is probably one of the most delightful apps that I've used. So you said you work on the core UI components and the platform stuff. Well done. The app is so nice. It's a very beautiful, pleasant app.
It's so funny, and I think all software developers have this, but it's so funny to hear you say that, because every time I open the app, the only thing I can see is every outstanding bug or jitter or frame trap. And so when people are like, oh, I love Pinterest, I'm like, oh, really? Wow, look at that. It is a really, really cool app, though.
You said something that was very interesting to me right when we first started talking to you, and Kaushik mentioned it again, is that you work on the core UI team. Is that right?
Yes, core UI.
What exactly is a core UI team? You said you came from a small startup where four people are, you know, you're kind of touching many different code bases and kind of shipping everything. And there's a lot of folks that listen to this podcast that are in that situation and they don't have a core UI team. What exactly is a core UI team, and why is it important to a company like Pinterest?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's something that I'm still figuring out, is that transition from a company where one person will do everything to a company at Pinterest's size and scale. And so the reason we have platform teams and core UI teams in general is that Pinterest, like most other companies still finding their way in the world, they need to ship quickly or we're going to go out of business. There's a lot of competition in the market. And so one of the ways we do that is we have people who focus on our core surface areas. So for us, Pinterest pins are very, very iconic. You know, the boards, the collections that you organize pins to are very iconic. And those are core to our app, and they're core to the app in ways that are unlikely to change rapidly in the short term. And so because of that, we have teams dedicated to maintaining those for perf and quality and standards. And we allow our product engineers to go off and do new development without having to maintain the current code base. And so, like, one example of that, the one that I came into Pinterest to do was video. So I built a video component, and our product teams don't have to worry about maintaining that or fixing bugs with it or making sure the logging is correct or any of that. They can just go and plug that into different experiences that they're prototyping. And the idea there is that they can move quickly because they don't have to deal with those stability and perf and like other overheads that you want for moving fast and not breaking things.
Nice. A quick side question along those lines. So you said there's a core UI team. Is the Android app partitioned basically based on feature? Is it, or do you have like modules, like Gradle modules? This is just like out of curiosity for like how an app as big as Pinterest is structured.
Yeah, so we are trying to move in that direction. I think one of the things that's really fun about being at Pinterest is we had this app that was written by one person predominantly back when Pinterest was very, very small. And it scaled all the way up to this point where we have hundreds of millions of users.
Wow.
And we're getting to, it's really incredible. I love Carl. So shout out to Carl. How he got his job at Pinterest is a whole other story. That's very interesting. But anywho, you know, it's scaled, but now we're at this point where you need to mature the code base. And one of the things that we're looking at for making that transition into a stable, bigger company code base is modularizing. Mm-hmm. And so we've started to pull a few things out, but that's a pretty big process once you have 6 years of code that you're working with.
Oh, yeah.
Modularizing it is a one step at a time sort of deal. But a lot of that code is still in a single app module that we're working to modularize.
Got it. Another question that I had with respect to the Pinterest app is, so I'm a big fan of like beautiful type. And I did notice that the Pinterest app appears to have like a custom font, right?
Yes.
This is not the native font. So I'm curious how that went about, because historically custom fonts in Android have not been very easy until maybe a friend of the show, Chris Jenkins, came up with the Calligraphy library, which was a godsend for custom fonts. And of course, now with the support library, and I I don't recall the API version, but we have at this point native custom font support in the platform, right? I'm curious just how Pinterest went about that, because Pinterest seems like it looks like you folks care very deeply about design. That's very evident from the app. So I'm curious how you managed to keep that check.
Yeah, so you said that it was difficult to do or wasn't always the easiest to do, and you're right. The fonts are really important to our designers. They care really deeply about details like that. But we had the same issues that a lot of other apps have when we were introducing them. I did not do the font work. That was one of our engineers named Torben, and he was working on that. And I can tell you that it's really hard for localization. Like some of the mm-hmm. drop letters were getting cut, and it was a whole process. I don't have as much context on it as he does, so I don't want to speak to, you know, what his work was. But I do know that I've seen calligraphy in our code base before, and so I'm sure that much of Chris's work influenced the team when they were integrating that.
Very cool. A common question that most folks have is with respect to material design. This is a fantastic gift that Google has given us with respect to having a set of default design components that just help improve the app's design. That being said, a question or a ding sort of that people, many developers point is that if you follow the material style, the material design style guides, essentially what happens is the app tends to lose character, so to speak, if that makes sense, right? Is this something Pinterest seems to maintain that character and also has a lot of the touches, so to speak, of material design, right? Is this something that was like a conscious choice that was made? Can you talk a little about that aspect?
Yeah, I don't know that it was conscious. Well, I should say it was definitely conscious to keep Pinterest a Pinterest experience. It's very important to our designers that people can feel at home on Pinterest no matter where they're using it. And there were a lot of discussions around that. But obviously, as an Android team, we felt really strongly about making sure that we were bringing the best Android experience and not the best iOS port to Android experience. And so we definitely had a lot of conversations with them about how to keep that experience true to what we wanted to offer pinners without sacrificing that Androidiness. And I think one way that was possible was that our designers pored over the material design guidelines, and they were influenced by it without necessarily following every single rule. So I was actually surprised. It's in Silicon Valley, a lot of people say, oh, our designers don't like designing for Android. But I can walk up to a lot of designers at Pinterest and have full conversations with them about what they do and don't like about material design. And just that knowledge of having read through it, even if they're not abiding by every single part of it, I think it gives them a good foundation for knowing what is a good experience for Android, and where they can push the boundaries and maybe depart and keep a little of that Pinterest spark. I think one of the big discussions that we had actually was bottom nav. Mm-hmm. That was really controversial, and we discussed it for a long time. And material design was actually the tipping point, because we didn't want to depart from what was a standard Android experience. Mm-hmm. And then when material design kind of gave that, like, oh, it's okay to do this, then we did a lot more serious explorations. But we were waiting for that confirmation that this was indeed Androidy enough for the Android club.
So it's very interesting you talk that deep about Android, and you actually have worked with your team to make sure that you adhere to kind of that spec to stay within the actual native experience for Android. And I think that's fantastic. At the same token, I see a lot of the things in the Pinterest app which are very unique to Pinterest, which Kaushik and you have touched on as well. And the question I have for you is, on your core UI team, do you work with maybe the web team and maybe the iOS team to make sure that you guys are all and folks are adhering to the same, you know, styles across the board? Hey, these corners are always at this radius, and we're always going to have these drop shadows, and that we're going to use these fonts, just so the experience from when I'm on my desktop and I hop over to my Android phone, and then maybe I use my wife's iPad or whatever, all that experience is the same. Do you work with those teams, or how does that work internally?
Yeah. Absolutely. So you're correct, and that's exactly what my team takes care of as well. So we have a design language. There was a talk at DroidCon New York, I think 2 years ago, by Torben and Lynn about Brio, which is our design language. And the point of Brio was that designers would be able to give us designs and not worry about what surface they were implemented on, because we would divide by columns and by space on the screen, not pixels. And so you would say, like, this is going to be designed based on proportions. And the thesis there was that that would scale from a very small phone to a tablet to web, iOS's, devices. And so they could just hand off a spec and we would be able to work with that anywhere without worrying about the actual measurements.
So kind of brings me to the next question that I have. And this is mainly for the folks that are listening, because I've already been down this road and so have you, and possibly Kaushik, you may have as well. If someone is listening to this and they think, wow, this is a fantastic idea to have kind of this design language, and it's something I'd like to get started with at my company, what's the best way for them to do that? If, you know, just even from the Android perspective, I guess it's a few questions in one. How do they get started? And then if they are starting, for an Android perspective, are you implementing these things as just custom views in an application? Is it just inside of a package, or is it inside of a module or a library that you're importing through Gradle? Or what does that whole picture look like, and how would I get started doing that?
Yeah, so I just want to acknowledge that my teammates, Alice and Malika, actually did a lot of this work before I joined the team a couple months ago. And so, one, if you want to do this at your company, you should find them on Twitter. I can give you their handles. In terms of how to get started, we pulled these components into their own module, and I think the reasons they're not surprising to anybody who hears that, which is to keep them separated from any specific logic tied to one app, so that you can use them in different scenarios and they're not really tightly entwined with any business logic for a particular use case.
All right. So the other thing that I wanted to bring up is, Christina, I know you've dabbled a little with the dark side, which is basically Swift.
Oh, no. Oh, yes. And all the yeses.
Yeah. And I think we've had maybe a Twitter conversation on this. I don't recall exactly. But you've worked with both Swift and obviously Kotlin. You've given some amazing talks about Kotlin. We'll make sure to add links to that, because some of your talks on Kotlin are like the best out there. So,
oh my gosh, what?
So my question though is, well, you've worked with Swift, like I think you've actually, you know, worked with Swift to ship something in Swift, right?
Yep.
So what are your thoughts on Swift versus Kotlin? Tell us your experience having dealt with the dark side.
Well, I mean, Swift versus Kotlin, this is like funny to me, because of course, like, who doesn't want their friends to be happy, right? Like, friends don't let friends write bad code. I think that I love Kotlin. Like, it makes me happy. It brings so much joy to my development process. And I feel the same way about Swift. And I think that's an amazing thing, that both platforms can have these languages that just make coming into work such a pleasure. And so for that, my thoughts are, thank goodness that both iOS and Android have these languages that are amazing and modern and give us the ability to express ourselves in the way that we want.
Oh my God, you are so positive. Here I am, like, trying so hard to, like, stir the pot, and you're giving, like, these perfect sort of positive answers.
Well, I really do love both languages. Like, I adore them both. It's like, you know, being a kid in a candy shop, and there's all of these nooks and crannies, and they're different nooks and crannies for each language. And so you just get to skip around and be like, oh, what's over there? Oh, this is cool. And
oh, there's JavaScript.
Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, boy. Okay. My positivity has a few limits to it.
I got it, Kaushik. I got it.
You found the crack.
Irrationally positive is not something that she buys. So let's maybe, like, stir the pot in that direction, I think.
Okay.
So what were some things that you picked up in Swift that you thought maybe Kotlin could incorporate? Just because I think most folks here at least would be more familiar with Kotlin. So if you can tell us about something that Swift has that maybe you would like to see at some point in Kotlin, that would be really helpful.
Yeah.
I mean, Swift and Kotlin, as you all are both aware, are very similar languages. And so I think There's nothing at a huge fundamental level that I think, oh, this is a gaping hole that neither language, you know, covers even slightly. I think that a lot of the things that I love about Swift are little stepping stones over what's there in Kotlin. Like, whenever anybody asks me, I have this very strong love affair with Swift's enums. I just really, really adore them. Sealed classes go some of that way for us in Kotlin, but if you've used Swift's enums, they're like so amazing. And I wish that we had those in Kotlin. I think they're also doing some work with things that we would traditionally use libraries for, or that we would have to write a lot of boilerplate. And I think one that comes to mind is that they have these like codable conformances in Swift, which for us would be basically like serialization. And so types, as long as they're codable, you can get this codable interface that you can adhere to. And if every field in that interface is also codable, then the whole thing is codable. And I think that's really cool, because that means that you're no longer writing that serialization code of like in, and then they all have to be in the same order as when you do the out. And you can switch out what they're being coded into. So if that's JSON or if it's some other format, then it's all there. And I think that it's really cool that there's something like that that exists at a language level. And that's probably a controversial thing to say. I think people will say, oh, well, you know, like, keep that out of the language. It should be a tool that you pull in. But I personally think that that's pretty cool, because it comes up so often and it's a pain point. And then I guess the last thing that I would say is structs. Like, it's one of the things in Kotlin that I miss a lot. But this idea that you have value types and you have reference types, like, that's so, so powerful. And I know that Kotlin will eventually get there, but I miss having that out of the box, even though caveat structs were a very large pain point in Swift. So I'm not going to paint the rosiest of pictures of them, but the fact that they're there, I think that's really, really powerful.
Now, you did a talk just recently at DroidCon NYC, and I was actually in the audience watching the talk. It was fantastic. And it was with one of our previous guests, Huynh, here on the show.
Huynh!
Yes, indeed. And it was on something that was which, I don't know how the best way to explain this, seems like it might be very boring, but you made it very exciting. And that topic was co and contravariance, which probably
just
lost.
What's boring about covariance? What could be more fun? Friday night party.
So I'm wondering if you might be able to take just a few minutes, and I know we don't have all the time to go through everything in the talk, but maybe just talk about what covariance and contravariance is, and why should developers care about it, and why should they know what it is and how to use it to their benefit?
Yeah, so, it's a lot in a couple sentences, but
totally.
Covariance and contravariance, they're describing this ability that developers have when working with generics to take something that's more specific and assign it to something that's less specific, or the inversion of that, take something that's more specific and assign it to something that's less specific in covariance and contravariance. And so what that means is that you're able to manage the relationship of the A and B of a foo A and foo B. So it's not how like foo A relates to foo B. It's specifically, if you have foo A and foo B, how A relates to B. And this is actually building on our natural intuition, because a lot of people will say, okay, I have a list of numbers, I should be able to add an int to it. But if you don't have this concept, then you can't do things like that, because int and numbers are different types, even though you would immediately say from your intuition, hey, but like an int is a number, I should be able to put it in this list. Mm-hmm. That's what you're getting when you understand and you can use covariance and contravariance. And the TLDR on like why you care is that it gives you that extra flexibility without sacrificing safety. Like, the whole premise of covariance and contravariance is I am going to give myself the most flexible way of using this generic parameter without sacrificing safety. And that's why we have the in and out keywords in Kotlin, is that we're saying, if we use this thing in this one location, I can guarantee that it'll be safe for this whole range of inputs outside of the one that's an exact match. And likewise, if I use it in this other location, I can guarantee that it's safe for all of these outputs aside from an exact match. And so a world in which you don't have that, you can still get things done, but you have to have an exact match everywhere, which means that you're just going to be writing a lot more code. And so, yeah, I think, why does it matter? Well, because you can write less code.
Okay, now if you're driving in the car, I need you to pause this. I need you to rewind it for about 2 minutes and listen to that whole thing again. There's so much info in there. It's fantastic.
It's gold.
Oh, no.
It's gold.
Was it too much?
No, not at all. In fact, I think and Donald, definitely drop a link to the talk that he went and saw as well. And
yep.
The transition of how you explained it was amazing as well, right? You started out with the in-out. Because the other thing is this whole concept of like covariance, contravariance, invariance, these are concepts. Like, you know, we don't necessarily have a contravariant or covariant keyword. The only two keywords that Kotlin provides, like you said, is the in and out, right? And those enable these three concepts, right? And invariance makes sense, right? It's like almost like one-to-one equal. Like if you want to explicitly be tight about like the types, invariance makes sense. Even I would say covariance, like, you know, the if you mentioned the whole B is an A, therefore I expect foo of A to be able to take in B, right? Like the number is an int case. That also made sense.
Yep.
The one that really got me scratching my head in the early days was the contravariance part, right? Like why would I ever want the reverse? Right, like for example, and correct me if I'm explaining this or like if I'm giving an example incorrectly here. But if I understand what contravariance is essentially what you're saying is, if B is a type of A, then what I would expect is that foo of B should be able to contain A. Right? Is that a fair summary?
I am so lost in the A's and B's at this point. But I believe you're a smart person, so yes. I'll say yes on trust alone.
You're really wrong, madam.
I guess my intuition on that is that the way I visualize it in my head is these funnels. And so it gets to this point where if someone is saying, hey, like I need an animal, you can give them a cat or you can give them a dog and any of those will suffice. And so when I'm thinking about the reverse, it's like, oh, well, you know, I can give you this specific implementation, but you don't really care because all you need is this, you know, this thing at a higher level. So like, yes, I can give you a cat, but if you only want an animal, it really doesn't matter to you that it's a cat. And likewise, like if I need to take an animal, then I can, you know, like, I guess I'm getting lost in the example, but to me, it's this idea of having a funnel. And so you can narrow the funnel or you can widen the funnel, and it's all based on what your end user needs are. And so that's kind of how I keep it straight in my head, is this idea of narrowing and widening the funnel to only what you specifically care about.
I like that analogy, a funnel analogy. That's pretty cool.
The whole topic around covariance and everything around it is very, it's really easy to twist your words and get confused.
Right.
And I watched the talk live in New York City. I thought it was really good. By the time I got back on the train that evening, I had already forgot three quarters of it. And then I came home and I've probably watched that talk two or three times since then. And the thing that really helped me solidify a lot of the concepts was actually watching your talk and then opening up Android Studio, and I created a scratch file. If you're not sure how to create a scratch file, just do the all commands action. I think it's command shift A and search for scratch. And you open a Kotlin scratch file, and I kind of just copied the code from what I saw on the slides and played with all of the, you know, in, the out, contravariant stuff. And then I saw the errors in the IDE. And that was what really made things like, oh, so I can do this and this will happen. If I do that, that will happen. So if you're really looking to kind of like solidify that, I would definitely recommend that approach, because then you can actually play with the code and start switching things around and see how it works.
Yeah, that's actually, I'm so happy to hear you say that, because Wynn and I, we had this crazy idea that we would do a presentation that was just entirely in the IDE. And we were inspired by other people who had done that before. But the premise of that was that loop of feedback was so much more real in the IDE than it is on slides.
Yep.
And so it was just so helpful to be in the IDE and say, oh, here's what this means. Do you want to see what it is in practice? And then comment out a line and the whole IDE blows up in red. And then you put the in keyword back and now it's all compiling. And so we were experimenting with that form. And I think we heard a lot of what you're saying, which is that form of learning is a really amazing form of learning that kind of deviates from standard and what we see at conferences a lot. But there's a lot of power in just being able to see the compiler correct you as you work through these problems and say, nope, that's not right. Or, yep, this is fine. Everything compiles. I love it. I'm really excited to see how we can use that sort of feedback to help make learning Android better in the future.
I think what you did there at DroidCon was, you know, you really tested the waters with a presentation style, and I'm glad that you did that because it really reminded me of, you know, screencasting and video casting, which I do a lot of. And when I saw this on stage live, I said, wow, they're doing this live, and I'm getting the same benefits of an in-person type of presentation, but then I also see it as if I were watching kind of a screencast because you're just, like you said, you're changing something. The entire IDE, all the colors just kind of go crazy, and I see it happen in real time, and it's almost like you're showing me, which you kind of were live coding, which most people shy away from nowadays. So kudos to you folks for actually getting up on stage and trying something new and doing this, which most people are scared of.
Yeah, we were petrified, absolutely petrified. But it's good to get outside of your comfort zone. And I think the benefit to that too is what you were saying, which is that if all we're doing is stepping through this playground of code, then I can put my code up at the end of the talk, and I did, and people can download that and step through the exact same playground. And so it has all the classes and they can comment them out and they could add a null upper bound to some generic and see what happens. And there's something really cool about that distributed model of, yes, you were there in the audience and that's cool, but hopefully someone could take those materials who wasn't there in the audience and have just as great of a learning experience. Mm-hmm. Not there yet, but that's the hope of just being able to give people these snippets of code and have them have a place that they can go and poke it and break it and see what happens.
Oh, absolutely. And I think like this is also extremely shareable, right? For example, now if I have to demonstrate the in-out, because I think that's exactly what you did in the talk too, right? The in-out example, the interface thing, I would just keep that handy, like, you know, and anytime someone wants to understand this, I would just literally paste that code like in an ID and I would just like mark it in, mark it out, show them the errors and boom, just like that, right? Like it's so much more easier than even trying to explain it in words.
This makes me so happy. I'm going to tell Wynn, or maybe Wynn will listen. I'll tell her if she doesn't listen.
Wynn, you better be listening.
Yeah, Wynn, you better be listening. Yeah. This is your shout out. But that makes me so happy because we care a lot about conferences and the people who attend them. And so it's really cool to get feedback like this.
Are these code snippets published anywhere?
Yeah, absolutely. They're on our GitHubs.
Excellent. And we'll make sure to add links to that.
Yeah, I remember someone asking online right after your talk happened, hey, where can I get the slides? And at that point in time, you're like, well, I'm not really sure how I'm going to get this out there. What did you end up doing? Just posting it on GitHub, like you said, or did you actually kind of publish some type of slide format?
Yeah, so I just posted it on GitHub. Okay. My reaction to that person who had asked was, are there slides? And the answer was no, because it was all code. Mm-hmm. So I was a little bit like, well, there were no slides, but I can send you the code. And so the code itself is just on GitHub and you can pull it down and it's all there, everything that I used. And we also gave that talk in an updated form at KotlinConf. So same code. We polished it a little bit at KotlinConf, but otherwise it's mostly the same material. So either one of those talks, the code is the same on GitHub.
We do have a lot of folks who are presenters and speakers that listen to the show, and other folks who maybe do internal presentations or just want to get into speaking in a technical conference as well. And they may be listening to this and really like this concept as well. Maybe if you would be so kind to kind of share some of your trials and tribulations that you faced during the development of this talk. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to use this type of method for a talk instead of firing up Keynote or PowerPoint and creating a slide deck that way, and I wanted to follow the same format, what are some tips that you would give someone that's attempting to go down this road for the first time that wants to use this style of presenting, you know, inside the IDE?
Yeah, I would say that Well, this sounds so silly, but my biggest problem was that I noticed that code that looked really good on my screen, the colors were completely off when I was presenting. And code without syntax highlighting is absolutely awful. Oh, yeah. And I had that problem multiple times where on my screen, there was great contrast. And then I looked and the audience was looking at this thing that just was some blob of text. And that's like a really bad experience. So I'm working on that going forward. And if you're going to do this, I would keep an eye out for that, because it's not effective when you try to show that something is not compiling if you can't even see the red line that demarcates something that's not compiling. But in terms of how to actually create the talk, I don't know. It's almost like, well, how does anybody write anything? I guess.
How does anybody write anything? Yes.
Yeah,
that is the question.
Like, how does someone write a book? I don't know. It probably depends on the person.
Well, but if only we knew someone who wrote a book here.
Oh, yeah. How did you write a book? No, okay. But I think for Wynn and I, one of the starting points that we always, always come back to is, well, first, we source the material from people saying, what are you finding interesting? Mm-hmm. What is difficult? And then when we try to find code snippets, we're taking those concepts and we're saying, where did we find them difficult in a real example? And so a lot of those things that you see coming in will start actually at the end and say, okay, so you need a DSL for this case. Like, it would be really nice to have a DSL for this case. Or covariance and contravariance make this thing possible, and we really want this thing as developers. And then we'll work back from there to, what do you need to know about that thing to make it relevant? And what do you need to know about that thing to make that you know, stepping stone relevant? And kind of work back to this point where you're unraveling it piece by piece and adding or taking away, I should say, context until you get to the simplest possible starting spot. So that sounds counterintuitive to start with the end in mind, but I think that's probably it's how we do it. And I'm not going to stand here and say that we're the best at doing this, but I think it's useful to figure out what you want the audience to know about that concept and then just build on that by saying, okay, well, you need to understand this basis to get there, and you need to understand this basis to build this concept that you're using. So let's start breaking those out into these little code snippets.
Yeah, that's perfect. I mean, it's the whole learning by example thing, right? I think you hit that like in the perfect way. You start off by the thing that we want, and then using those examples, like, you whittle it down. And you folks did a fantastic job, because in the end, you did talk about some really hardcore theory, right? It wasn't necessarily just like, oh, this is how you use this, this is how you use that. You started off there, but then you slowly started peeling the layers until, like, you were at the core. So well done.
And like the first slide of that talk was like, here is the type system in a picture. And the only thing that we wanted them to get from that was that it was an organized picture. Like, if that was the only information that you took from that, then you had succeeded. You were doing great. Because the idea was to start with this notion that the type system is orderly. And then from there, we talked about, okay, well, it's orderly. What does that get you? Well, that means that you can't assign something that's non-null to, or something that's nullable to a non-null type, which is something that we all take for granted. It's like, yes, Kotlin has this thing. And so, yeah, it was definitely a very slow build. But I think in the end, the benefit of establishing all of those little pieces along the way was that you could get to this complicated part, and, like, hopefully it wasn't too overwhelming. I think it still was, but the idea being, it was not all or nothing.
No, it was fantastic. I enjoyed the talk thoroughly. So, Christina, we've been talking for some time, and one thing that we also want to ask is, obviously, Kotlin was the highlight last year, right? What excites you about Android development for the future?
Well, was last year the only Kotlin year? Is, like, all of the above an example or an okay answer? Because I think it's cliche, but Kotlin, the fight to get Kotlin mainstream was interesting, and I learned a lot from it, and I met some really cool people who were all very rebellious like me. But I think that what's so much more interesting than all of that is the way it's changing how people approach their code today. And I am far more interested in the next year of Kotlin usage as so many people dip their toes in the water and you know, start adopting it and start seeing how it works for them and for their code base, and start talking about nullability and mutability as these things that everybody cares about, whereas before it might not have been that way for so many people. Like, that part of seeing the language shape how people interact with Android development is way more interesting to me and is what I'm super excited about.
Oh, that's a great answer. I mean, even like the functional constructs, right? Like, a lot of this functional stuff now is just native to the language. So that inherently makes most of us developers aware of this concept. And that does improve us in many ways, right? Like, I don't think it's too, it's a stretch to say that being more familiar with the concepts of Kotlin actually makes us better developers, because it's expanding our horizon and like some of these concepts that we understand.
Yeah, and I was going to say it leads right into that, which is that I think FRP, functional reactive programming, is becoming a lot more mainstream. And we can see this with the Aero library in Kotlin that people are working on. We can also see it on iOS with work from people like Chris Idoff. And those things are really exciting to me as well. And I think that the language is definitely a gateway drug into a lot of those concepts. And so at a high level, I'm super excited about the fact that a lot of these functional paradigms seem to be coming to Android and seem to be getting wider adoption, although not blind adoption, which is great. And like, the language, I think, is just part and parcel of that. So it's a cop-out to say that I'm excited for the same thing that I was excited for last year, but it's just totally true.
Not at all. And Christina, you seem to be someone who has all the answers.
What? No!
Well, your answers so far, like, some of them are really frustrating, but they're so right, and maybe that's why. So.
Well, I aim to please. Service organization.
Well, if folks are curious to ask you more questions and get more answers, what's a good way they can do that?
I'm on the Twitter sphere. I got hip. So I have a handle. It's at Run Christina Run. And if anybody wants to be internet friends, they can find me there.
Run Christina Run. Perfect. Don, you also have many answers. So as the established graybeard, what is a good place to reach you for answers?
The best place to reach me is going to be on Twitter at Don Felker, and the same handle on Instagram if you want to look at fancy photos.
Very cool.
And Kaushik, if folks want to find out what you're up to and how you're working in the functional reactive area and all things Kotlin, where do they find you?
Kaushik Gopal on Twitter, which is, again, my name. Very straightforward. Yeah, I'm also on Instagram. I have funky car pictures. That's the only thing you'll probably find in my Instagram.
Wait, what type of cars?
So I have this weird thing that I started some time back. As I walk through the city, I'll find this really... I mean, it's all kinds of cars. Like, some of these are like vintage cars. Some of these are like, you know, modern cars. Some of these are like completely pimped out cars. Just like different kinds of things. Anytime I see something that's interesting, I just like take a picture and I post it in the Instagram. So
that's awesome.
So if folks are curious, they can catch me there. All right, thank you all so much for listening. Christina, always such an amazing pleasure to have you on. Your energy, despite you being a little sick, is always such a pleasure. Thank you for coming on the show. And I know you're not keeping too well, but you still have come and lifted our spirits. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I had so much fun.
Right before we get out of here, I'd like to take a few moments to thank our sponsor for this episode, and that's Mapbox. If you're looking for a map and you want to put it inside of your application, you definitely need to check out Mapbox. They provide turn-by-turn driving for walking, driving, biking. They offer complete map design control. It's a tremendously huge thing. They offer you all kinds of different functionality, such as geocoding, reverse geocoding, location, you name it. Mapbox has got you covered. If you're interested, go to mapbox.com/android to get started. Again, that's mapbox.com/android.
That's it for the show, folks. Fragmented is hosted by Don Felker and me, Kaushik Gopal. We edit and produce all the episodes here on Fragmented. Sarah the Amazing Jackson from the Spec Network helps with production assistance and wraps our final mix. Our theme and ad music is by the national recording artist Blueprint from Weightless Recordings. You can find more Fragmented episodes at fragmentedpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.